I'm Lee Foster. You're listening to Action, the No Bullshit podcast dedicated to the pursuit of acting excellence. This episode is brought to you by Backstage. Become a member and get access to more performing arts jobs than any other platform. To try it for free for 30 days, go to backstage.com/action. Again, that's backstage.com/action. Become a member like me. All right, so Welker White and Damian Young, thanks for being on Action.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
How did this meeting actually happen?
Well, it happened because I am a fan of your podcast, and I teach, well, Damian and I teach together, and we teach another number of places, but by myself, I teach in the MFA program at Brooklyn College, in the MFA acting program. And in the spring, we always do a unit on auditions and the business. And there are always lots of very essential, basic questions that actors are asking me. And sometimes I feel that I'm not the best person to answer them. I'm in my 50s, and the business is quite different, I think, in many ways for actors just coming into it now. And they would ask me questions, and I think, gosh, I'm not sure I have the right answer to that. So I'm always looking for resources for them and for podcasts, and I came across yours, and I thought it was excellent. And as you know, I contacted you and let you know how helpful it had been, and we just started to chat about my work as well.
Yeah, and we had a phone conversation, and we were talking about some of the training that you do, the two of you do, and I thought it was super interesting, so I wanted to have you on. Why don't you just give me a background, the both of you, of just how you got into acting and some of your accomplishments and whatnot. or I'll do it if I have to. I have it right here in front of me.
Well, I mean, the short story for me is I wasn't really good at anything else. I was a very bad student. In college, and they had a great theater program, they had a great classics department, a great English department. I was basically only interested in the theater, and by that I mean that's the only thing I really showed up for on time. It was rehearsal and theater classes. So I left school and I came to New York. I apprenticed at Williamstown Theater Festival. That was my first sort of introduction to the professional theater world. And then when I was in New York, pretty quickly, some friends and I had a theater company. We started a theater company in Tribeca in a warehouse, a 10,000 square foot warehouse that we were allowed to use for free because of the state of real estate at the time. And so we just went nuts. We did the original plays. We had a cabaret. There was a time of like a lot of performance art in New York. So we had Ethel Eichelberger, we had Penny Arcade, we had Blue Man before they were at the Astor Place Theater. We had a live soap opera. So it was just a constant, what are we going to do on Friday? And we'd have to write stuff and throw it up there and see what the audience liked. We had a bar. So it was a very exciting time, you know, to do free theater. And I learned so much about, you know, audiences, storytelling, character work. And then eventually some independent film directors started to come around. This was, I guess, in the 80s, 90s when independent film was starting to become kind of a big deal. And one in particular was Hal Hartley. And so I did a number of pictures with him. And that was sort of my introduction to the bigger world, I guess. And as a result of that, I got more work in, you know, legit theater, you know, that actually paid, and movies and television. That's how I trained, was just by guessing. And just doing what, you know, we thought was going to be entertaining and funny and fun. That's pretty much how I got started. And then, you know, and then along the way, I've done a lot of series regulars, recurring characters, one-offs, small parts in big movies, big parts in small movies. You know, I've put together a journeyman's career as a result.
Yeah, you have over 100 credited film and television appearances, some of which include Homeland, House of Cards, The Good Wife, Californication, Law and Order, Ozark, which I was telling your wife is one of my favorite shows, if not my favorite show. Yeah, who are you on that? Were you on the earlier seasons as well?
I was season two. I think I might have been five or six episodes. I can't remember. There's a storyline about a real estate developer who kind of has a crush on Laura Linney's character, and I'm sort of his lawyer fixer.
Right. Yeah. Of course. Of course. Yes.
So I'm doing a few episodes this year, and I have a pretty good idea that I'm not going to die in the last episode, but I really don't know.
It's always nice when you're not dead. All right. Cool. Welker, you're up.
I'm up. Well, my background is that I started at Indiana University, and I only lasted a year there, and I transferred where Damien and I met. Before transferring to NYU undergrad, I attended a program that has this very lofty title now called the National Theater Institute. Was it always called that when we went there too? So it's at the site of Eugene O'Neill's homestead up in Waterford, Connecticut, which is an absolutely beautiful location. And they're very famous for the Playwrights Conference in the summer, where they develop new works. And in the winter, they have a fall semester and a spring semester where college students can take a semester and go and have a very wonderful immersive experience with all sorts of aspects of their training. And so Damien and I met there. From there, I went to NYU undergrad in the BFA program, and I didn't quite finish. So I got plucked out of there and started working right away. I was one of those sort of lucky kids who their first audition, their first professional audition, I booked the first audition. And from there I worked.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was the first audition I've had, which was a Lamford Wilson play called Lemon Sky. Fabulous play. Cynthia Nixon and I played sisters in that play. And she at the time, this is a kind of a famous story, but she at the time was just coming off of doing two Broadway shows at the same time. She was doing Hurley Burley and The Real Thing, which were one block from each other. They were going up every night at 8 o'clock, and she would do the first act of one of the plays, run across the street, finish up the first act of the other play, run back, finish something in the second act, run back, take her bow, run back, take her bow. So she had also done a Lanford Wilson play called The Fifth of July, which had been televised for Channel 13 for PBS at the time. So I was just obsessed with Cynthia, who was only just a year younger than me. So I was, 19 or 20 and in that play, and to have my first play get to play.
Jeff Daniels was in it.
Jeff Daniels was in it, and Jill Eikenberry, really phenomenal cast. So I was super lucky because I was thrust into this environment with just these phenomenal actors and a phenomenal director, Mary Robinson, who ironically many years later became my professor when I went back and got an MFA in theater directing. In between those two things, I dropped out of college. I started working a lot. I did, I would say, primarily new plays in terms of theater, and also started working in film and television, and worked a ton and had a blast and learned so much. And then in my mid-30s, I had kids at that time, young children, and I really didn't want to go out of town for work so much for theater for long stretches. And the work kind of dried up, and the interesting work kind of dried up for me. And so I decided, and this was after 9/11 as well, and I decided I didn't want to, the world was coming to an end, I didn't want to die without a degree to my name. So I went back to school and I got my undergraduate degree, and I loved it so much. I did an independent study essentially through CUNY's, and I got what's called a Bachelor of Science in Theater Studies. And I loved it so much that I decided I really wanted to get a master's. So I decided to get a master's in directing because I had been teaching all along. I'd always taught and I loved teaching. So that was about the master's I finished about 10 years ago now. And ever since I have been at Brooklyn College teaching. And a number of years ago, they came to me and the master's program came and said, you have a good amount of film and television in your professional history, would you design something for our students? And so that really was the catalyst for me asking myself, and Damien and I had over many, many years talked about what should the training for this look like? What could it look like?
What would have helped us when we were
what
coming
would have helped
up?
Us?
Because yeah. we didn't get anything
around film and television. And had always felt, even though at that point we had been working for 25 years in film and TV, and really never felt really great about our work on a consistent basis. And so our work together, our teaching together, was really born out of those conversations and out of my work at Brooklyn College, which has become really a wonderful laboratory for me. That's where I still do act as well.
Right. Yeah, Welker has been in many, many, many things. Law and Order, The Wolf of Wall Street, Sex and the City, Goodfellas, which I instantly recognized you from. You probably get that a lot. Right?
Yeah, like the TSA agents or customs agents when we're coming, you know, from overseas. We'll
recognize it seems to be a favorite of the customs agents.
Is that right? Oh, that's funny.
That was a while ago, too.
So then you guys decide to start a training system. And is it entirely based around film and television?
It is. And I would say we call it screen acting instead of camera acting or on camera acting or acting for the camera. And we can get into why we do that. But yes, it's based on or the foundational work that we're building from with students is cinematic storytelling, I would say. So sort of more on the end of narrative, cinematic, either television or film.
Mm-hmm. When I was training, I found that there was a severe lack of actual advice when it came to working on set. It was very theory based and it was hard to apply, which is part of the reason that I started this podcast. Let me just start. I want to hear about the training system, but I want to ask, What do you think the biggest hurdle for most actors, beginning actors coming into the business, trying to learn? What's the biggest hurdle? What's the hardest thing for them to do?
Well, it depends where the actor's coming from. If, you know, if they've had any kind of training, if it's mostly in theater and then they're moving on to the cinema or television, and, you know, there's lots of forms in this medium. There's, you know, from a sitcom to a, you know, to The Revenant is they're very different forms. So one, it depends upon where the actor is coming from. But I would say that we have found over the last few years that breaking down story and analyzing scripts is the biggest hurdle. And particularly for actors who have a lot of theater training, they will look, and I include myself in this group, look at a movie script or a television script and say, there's nothing here for me to work on. Dispelling that notion is opens up a whole world for people, I think. There is lots to explore. There's a lot to work on. I'm always surprised. The more I dig and the more I look at a script, writers are very good. They know what they're doing, by and large. And they give so much to the actor to funnel themselves through a character. And actors tend to, you know, only look at dialogue sometimes and say, there's not much there. What am I going to do? And so a lot of times actors will say, well, I've learned my lines. I haven't rehearsed, so I don't know what I'm going to do. And then show up on a set and sort of expect to be told what to do and how to do it, rather than bring something that they can collaborate with other people. And so, I don't know, that's my feelings of the hardest thing or the biggest hurdle that I've discovered.
I just had, the other day, I recorded a episode of this podcast with a friend of mine, Nelson, who is kind of in the beginning stages of his career. He met me through this podcast. And I had an audition, and I texted him afterwards, and I said, I'll bet you $1 million that I booked that role. And he said, done. And then I got put on hold, and I said, I got put on hold for that. And he said that he wanted to hear the process. He wanted to hear what I had done and why I was so confident. And so I said, sure, let's record it and I'll tell you. And basically the entire time I was talking to him about all the things that I thought everyone else was going to miss. There was all these opportunities, even though it was a co-star and it was 5-6 lines. There were all these opportunities that I knew that beginning actors were going to miss. And halfway through, I got a call from my agent telling me that I booked it, and you could hear it on the podcast.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Check?
Yeah, has he written you a check?
For $1 million.
Yeah, I think he's going to put the down payment on pretty soon. But yeah, that goes completely into what you were saying about, I think that that's only happened to me in the past year and a half or 2 years where I've understood the ideas. You have to understand the way that the reason the scene is there.
Yep.
Every scene has a meaning. Like, what is the meaning? What has to happen? How can you help that happen?
Yes. There's a lot of actors who don't look at the work, particularly in television and film, in that way. And I think you hit it on the head is, you know, every scene, there's a reason for that scene. How is the story being moved along? How is this character helping to move this story? And therefore, as an actor, how can I contribute to that? I think if you look at it that way, you can bring to bear all kinds of things that you have in your toolbox, your imagination, your life experience. And then it's really you coming through this character rather than having an idea of a character that then I will put on something that I haven't fully explored.
Absolutely. So where do you start in your workshop? What's step one?
I would say step one, before we get to any of the, we have a lot of exercises that we've devised where we've broken down behavioral language so that actors can in a moment or two have a kind of light bulb moment where they see how a camera needs to capture behavior and thought with enough time for an audience to be able to read what's happening. So that's sort of the basis. That's where we start in terms of the actual work. But where we start an intensive or a workshop is really about talking about this idea of a spectrum of the form, because so many actors have either gone already to classes that are, quote, on camera classes, and there's little distinction made between the different forms along that spectrum, or there's just an assumption that it's all the same thing, that acting in front of a camera is a certain kind of thing and acting on a stage is a certain kind of thing. And it's not. It demands all sorts of things from us, depending on how that story is going to move along and how that story is going to be told in order for an audience to read meaning in the story. So we would start there.
And a lot of that has to do with where does dialogue live in these particular forms? You know, how much of the narrative load is being carried by dialogue versus pictures? So if we're taking something that's, you know, highly cinematic, like a Terrence Malick film, it's primarily pictures. And actors have to know what the visual language is in order to speak it. If you're looking at The Big Bang Theory, that's primarily words. And it's closer to a play than anything else. So we try to break that down. Particularly with sometimes, you know, we'll go into graduate programs in theater training. And if they're in their second or third year, it's been so much about speech and dialogue. And so it's a real kind of a wrenching moment when they start to see, oh, words live in a different place. They take sort of a back seat to pictures. Then students are lost, and that's when we can help them.
This episode will continue right after this. Backstage has been a leader in the entertainment industry since the 60s. Their casting department publishes more than 30,000 casting notices every year, from projects ranging from major studio productions to indie films, both union and non-union. That's more than any other platform. I've been a member for a while now. I think you should be too. To try it for free for 30 days, go to backstage.com/action. That's backstage.com/action. Now back to the episode. So in just regular network television, is it primarily word-based?
Well, it depends. You know, procedurals, you know, that's you know, all, yeah. Or there's like kind of a genre now where 4 or 5 people stand in front of 6 or 7 screens And, you know, look at all the things happening all over the world, you know, and they're delivering exposition while they're looking at the screen. So we would be lost without the words there. That's different from, say, This Is Us, which is still very dialogue heavy, but we're also now in the world of sort of a more behavioral language. So even within network broadcast drama, you can get more and more niche-y in what these forms are.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from there then?
Well, we'd like to, and we tell our students this, we'd like to live more in the cinematic end of this spectrum because we think it's important to take students to that end of it so that they can immerse themselves in a visual language. So, I mean, one of the exercises we do, the first thing we do is we just have them partner up with somebody and we ask them to just look at something in the room and have the partner record them for a minute.
On their phone.
On their phone. Mm. And then have them come back. We don't show any of that, but we ask the students how that felt. And by and large, no one likes it.
To be recorded.
To be recorded. We just want them to have the experience. It's like, you don't have to do anything except take in your environment. And, you know, we ask them, how long did that minute feel? And, you know, most of them say, it felt like an hour. So the first thing we have to do is say, once the camera is on, everything changes. Everything changes about who we are and what we do and how we do it. So, you know, that's the hard part, you know, is that once you know you're being recorded, truth tends to fly away. And thinking that all you've been asked to do is to take in your environment, and you don't have to do any more of that. You don't have to project that to an audience. You don't have to amplify anything. Still, once the camera's on, people think, now I have to do something. I have to perform. And there's a lot of reasons why that's the case, but that's the challenge now, is to say, what do you have to do and what don't you have to do? And particularly for students who have a background in theater, the craft is how to amplify a performance to get it out to an audience. That's a good part of the craft. And when you see a great actor on stage, that's part of the excitement, is to see that craft. How is this person making me believe that they're on a side of a mountain when it's, you know, they're in a black box? And we don't by and large have to do that in cinema. We are on the side of the mountain. So, you know, knowing the given circumstance, and then we go on from there. And so that's our first exercise. And people tend to get a little deflated right off the bat. Like, geez, I had no idea. Just having a camera on me brings up all this anxiety and like a desire to telegraph something. Mm. But then we, you know, move on from there.
Yeah, we often describe what we do as kind of running on parallel tracks. One is what we've already touched on with you at the top of the podcast, which is we always say the actor's first job is to tell the story. So looking at what is the story I'm telling and learning how to tell that story, and what do I need to tell that story, what I not need to tell that story. But then the second track of what we work on is, how does the camera tell the story in this world? How's the camera going to tell the story? And so ultimately, and this doesn't happen in a week, it would happen over many years of someone's training and experience, but ultimately we want to be in a parallel process of telling the story with the camera. And so what we do start them on is a journey to beginning to integrate those two things, those two sides of the responsibility of the actor working in this medium, which is you're telling a story, but you're telling a story not to an audience. As Damien said, you're not getting it out to anyone. It doesn't need to go out to anyone. In the process of making, there is no audience yet. So then often the question is like, well, then what am I doing? So what does the camera need to see, and how does the camera see it? And then how does the camera, just functionally, how does the camera, or in terms of that process, how does the camera move and why does it go that way? And that gets to the language and grammar of film.
Yeah, the idea that there is no audience is, I think, a rough concept for particularly experienced actors. And we're of the firm belief that working on movies, there is no audience yet. that the camera is the delivery system to an audience. And I find that very liberating at this point in my career. I see that as something where I really only have to live through and serve the given circumstances and tell this story. And the part of my brain that has to get it out, I can shut off. And that gives me a lot of space to really immerse myself in the story. And I find that I'm looser, that each take is different. I can, there's a lot of different options that can happen. I'm playing with my fellow actors rather than trying to recreate some sort of calcified idea that I had going in. And knowing that there is never any right way to do it. There's never like a perfect way to do the scene. That I'm not in the business of recreating when I'm doing another take. I'm in the business of living through the moment. But that's a tough leap. You know, it's tough to say, if no one is watching, what am I doing? Because we're so used to that. We're so used to saying, well, the camera's on now. Now I have to perform. Mm-hmm. And it's the exact opposite.
So would you say that the problem that people run into with this is that they are acting on set trying to show an audience something? You know, they're trying to show an audience that they're disturbed as opposed to just being disturbed.
Or... Yes. I mean, there's two things that can happen. It's one is on one extreme is someone indicating the bejesus out of it. You know, yeah. They're trying to telegraph, this is how I feel at this moment. They're twisting their words around so that they make it clear that, you know, that this, me, the actor, knows what the words mean and I am getting it out to you. That's one end. The other end is a reaction against that, which is people shut down completely.
Yeah.
And actually, I would say, you know, I think there's this, the preconceived idea that you have to be, quote, small for on film, which we really buck up against. And, you know, I've loved seeing the Joker, Joaquin Phoenix's trailer this week. I mean, talk about an actor who is not small by any stretch of the imagination. And he's absolutely brilliant. The choices he makes are huge and massive and exciting and thrilling. But what we see most often is not what Damian just described as the extreme indicating. Although we sometimes see that, what we see most often is the absolute panic that they're going to do that. And we see people just go dead because they don't know what else to do.
So I have to say that my journey so far as an actor, I started with probably the way that most people start, which is the indicating. I mean, that's really a lot of times. That's I would say what bad act. That's what we see, right? Yes. People indicating how they're feeling or whatever. So I was doing that. And then I heard that a casting director told me that it's really about like throwing away the words, right? It's all about throwing away the words. So then I started doing that and I had some success with that, but then I got some feedback from a casting director through my agent and they said something like, we understand what he's trying to do, but he's doing it too much. And so then I went too far the other way. And now I feel like I'm in a good spot where I'm doing neither of those things. But I had to go through that. I mean, Definitely.
And part of it is people have this preconceived notion about what the medium requires, that it's real or natural and what tends to happen is everybody becomes casual.
Right.
Regardless of what the circumstances are, in an effort to be real. And, you know, a lot of times a student will say, well, this is how I would answer the phone. And then we have to go through the entire story and say, like, you built up to this moment of where you're answering the phone and it's still you, but you have gone through all these things. There's no general way to be natural or real. It's whatever the circumstances that the script gives you. So, you know, we hate this notion of big and small or
don't do anything.
Do less. it's whatever the story requires. You just, the thing that you don't have to do is get it out to an audience that, you know, is 1,000 people or 40 people.
Because you feel, you're worried they won't understand it.
Right.
They won't understand it. We right. watch human beings all the time, and we understand that often the internal life is not matching up to the externalization of the experience, right? So we understand that you don't have to demonstrate that for us, so we'll get it.
Yeah, in that audition that I was talking about on the last podcast, I actually want to ask you a question based on this, but there was a big period. Most of the audition was my character listening to another character kind of go off the rails, and it said that my character was disturbed from it. And I was telling my friend, the biggest mistake would be to try to show that you're disturbed.
Yeah.
That's where that's going to sink everyone's boat. Like 95% of the actors that go in there are going to act disturbed, and they're going to be counted out.
You know, as long as you're living through something, the story will take care of that for you.
Let the words do the work.
That's right. And the greatest possibility is that you're not disturbed at all. It's some other version of something. That in fact, if you're listening to someone's long monologue or speech through a phone call or whatever it is, that you don't have one feeling about it at all. You probably have that each word or each thing that's moving through that other person, you have a very specific point of view on every moment that person's going through. One of them may be disturbed, but one of them might be, it's hysterical, or one of them might be deep sadness or whatever. It should bring up, you know, the idea is that we are living through each moment, and there's not a sort of monolithic general response we have to anything, because that's not how we live in life. And we are meant to be recreating the illusion, that we're actually living life. So this is what we want to get to.
Yeah. We just recently watched Dog Day Afternoon again, and see those two, Pacino and Cazale, they play two very different people. They're in the same circumstance, but they're completely different. And one is absorbing information in one way, and one is absorbing information in another way. And they're both great, and they both need each other to tell this story. And it just, you know, performances like that next to each other really cement this idea that there is no one way
to respond to anything.
A lot of it just has to do with, in the given circumstances, how would you do this, you know? And the other hurdle that we have with actors is, by and large, actors feel like they're just not enough. They're not interesting enough. Hmm. They're not, I'm not good looking enough, but and that leads a lot of actors to say, me going through a moment or having an experience is not enough. People won't find me interesting. And so then they try to, and this is a slight variation of indicating, try to be interesting. Try to capture us, the audience. And we tell them time and time again, you are interesting all by yourself. If you are committed to the circumstances, if you are telling that story, you are fascinating. And that is something that's very hard for actors to believe.
A real person is always going to be more interesting than some fake creation.
Sometimes we tell people to get on the subway and look at the people opposite them. You know, everybody's going through a journey. Everybody is having an experience. You know, they're not telegraphing it to the world because they're on the subway. But if you look at them long enough, there's a whole journey happening there, and they are fascinating. But we don't believe it, you know. We think we have to add a little duck sauce to everything.
Well, we've always been looking at ourselves out of our own eyes. We've lived with ourselves forever, and to us, it may not be that interesting. But we don't realize that that's not interesting to other people. So where do you go? So you have people film each other for a minute, and it drives them crazy. And then where do you go from there?
Well, we have a whole bunch of exercises that we do before we ever get to any written pages with dialogue. So we have a whole range of exercises, some of which are shot in pairs on cell phones, some of which we shoot as a group and we all watch together on a monitor with a single camera that get to this idea of strengthening behavioral language without leaning yet on dialogue, without having it come directly from words, having it be these silent, basically silent scenes, start with silent, maybe what we'd call them, situations or segments of things, moments, and then we build those up and they become longer and longer to get to scenes that are full scenes that have full stories and full characters with full points of view on what's happening, but they just don't have words. That stream of exercises that lead up to that are very informative for most actors that work with us, because they start to see, what does the story need to be told? So we talked a lot about how there's not an audience, but eventually we get to a whole scene, right? And we know that an audience does have to see it. Eventually an audience has to watch this, and the audience has to understand what is happening. There are events in a scene, and you don't have any words to explain that. So how can you behaviorally respond to what's happening, have it move through you, have it mean something to you, get to the next moment that has to happen, which is the next event, without indicating?
So, I mean, one of the fun things we do is we have a number of these, and one is it's a wedding where someone is waiting for their partner to show up, and the partner's late, and then the partner shows up, and then they're watching the wedding, and then a third person arrives, and in the scenario that we've written, it turns out that the partner who was late and the third person who arrives had like a little tryst. And the third person has to somehow get the second person's glasses to him. It's, I don't know, this is not a good way to explain this. But, and what we do is with the rest of the class, we say, what, we ask the class watching these actors, what do we need to see? What do we need without character, without words, and not without telling the other actors how they're supposed to do something? But what do we need to tell this story about the relationship between the married couple, the people who have the affair, what's at stake, who might find out what, who knew what before? And it all just happens with behavior. We'll have one group of three, and then we'll swap in another group of three, and they have a different take on it, but they still have to honor the story. And so I think through exercises like that, actors get the idea that before I even think about character, before I even think about who this person is, I have to think about what this person is doing and how this story is going to be told and how we need to see it.
So each of those events is written on the page. I just want to be clear, is written out like a script, like a page of a film script. So what Damien is saying is that before the actors don't even get together and build a character or build a past relationship or anything. It's embedded in the events. It's embedded in the story. And we ask them simply to play out that story as specifically and cleanly as they can. And it is really fascinating to watch that as we go take after take, and as a group, we say, well, you know, I didn't really see a look to her coming in, maybe the third person coming in, that at least told me that they know each other. There's some recognition, right? And we do another take where that comes in, so forth and so on. And that after, you know, maybe working on it for about half an hour, you have an incredibly full scene with an incredible backstory, with an incredible stakes that's really lived in and deeply specific. And yet these actors never spoke to each other before jumping into the part of A, B, or C. And I think what's so informative about it is that, as Damien said, they learned very quickly that, well, number one, that many of us as actors lean very, very heavily on character. When, if we can fulfill first story, what exactly is that story? How does that story need to be told? Before we sort of lay on all these choices that we tend to like to go to really fast when we read something, the character will begin to emerge out of that.
Right.
And often a much clearer, more defined, more exciting way than the version that we have in our head about a character, and we want them to have come from a certain place or be this kind of person.
Sometimes an actor will come in and they'll be limping or something. And we're like, what's up with the limp? I thought it'd be interesting if I had a limp. Or in the middle of the scene, someone starts sneezing. We're like, what? That's not in the script. Well, I just thought it would be interesting if I had a cold during this. And that's for something else. That's later. Let's just tell the story.
And then it will be clear whether that would add to the story or actually detract from the story. And most of the time, we ask those kind of questions. And most of the time, as a group, we can see pretty quickly that would actually detract.
I always tell people that your choices have to make sense. If the choices don't make sense, they're not good choices.
Well said.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what, it has to make sense. That's first and foremost. One thing that I'm curious about, and I tell people this a lot, is that understanding the way that a scene works, let's say you have an audition, understanding the way that the scene works, understanding what needs to happen in the scene, and doing what you need to do to help that happen, being the character that you need to be that helps that story be told, is incredibly important. But I say something that's more important than that is basic believability. Now, I think that that's, to me, I think that basic believability is the most important thing. And I've said that a lot of times. And I know that then maybe that's controversial.
What do you mean by that?
How would you define that?
I mean that it's more important to be able to walk into an audition and do it in a way that sounds like the way I'm talking to you now. Sounds like humans talking to other humans. And if I completely miss the mark on what the scene is about and I make all the wrong choices, it's better to do that, but do it in a way that sounds like humans talking to other humans and doesn't look like acting, as opposed to understanding exactly what a scene is and then playing that perfectly, but not looking realistic, not looking believable.
I think those two things are closer together than you imagine.
Okay.
I think to be believable or it is to make choices that are in line with the script.
Okay.
And not add or subtract because you are worried about getting it out or that you will be understood. So I think those two things are linked. And I don't think there's necessarily right or wrong choices as long as you're adhering to the story.
Right.
And you're not trying to, make a circle a square. If you're given a circle, just, ride with the circle. It's a very interesting shape. Well, we also show clips to students. One that we start out with we like to show Westerns. Because there's not a lot of talking, and you have to get a lot of information with how characters are absorbing their environment. So that's something that I think students, are shocked to. If we show a clip of something and then we try to break it down about how much information we absorb in 2 minutes of a scene with no dialogue, and just how deliberate directors are in giving us that information, they are amazed how much they know before anybody has spoken a word.
Yeah, we're really big fans of integrating film clips into our workshops because what we know to be true, which is that all of us human beings, for the most part, unless we live off the grid or something, we consume thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of this stuff. On our phones and our TV sets and our computers, we're watching TV shows and films all the time. Most of us, and particularly those of us who are interested in working in this industry, are. And yet we have very little knowledge or understanding about why it looks the way it does for that particular story with those particular people. And we're of the frame of mind that if we can also teach actors to understand what it is they're seeing, they can utilize the time that they're watching those thousands of hours of content in a much more productive way and apply it back to their work. What makes a performance successful? Are there universal elements of a successful performance that we could all agree on? Those kind of questions. What makes me as a watcher, what moves me? Is it the performer? Is it the music? Is it the editing of particular visual side by side and juxtaposed next to each other? It's different all the time, of course. There's no one answer to that. But if I can learn more about how those things work, how they're put together, how they work on me as an audience, it will benefit me greatly as an actor.
Because our time on set is kind of rare, you know, and it's overwhelming. And, you know, and we're in a position now to be on a set and understand why a scene is being shot a certain way. And that gives me an enormous amount of freedom now to not worry about that anymore. But unless, you know, one has a lot of experience on set, it doesn't come naturally. So if you can put yourself on set while you're watching a movie, you can learn about why things are done a certain way. Why something is done with traditional coverage when we go from a master to and then go in tight, or why a scene is done in one shot.
Why is the camera placed low in the scene? Why is the camera placed high? Why do we never come in close with this particular filmmaker or in the scene? What is the filmmaker's choices trying to tell us? And if we know that, we can begin to use that in our work. We can begin to make choices in our work. And this is, you know, a more advanced thing to be doing. It takes a while to get there, but it's certainly enormously helpful, even from the beginning, to start to have some literacy around all of these decisions and choices that are being made by filmmakers and editors.
I mean, what we want to be as actors is full artistic collaborators. You know, we want to be telling the story along with everybody else. And the more information I have as an actor about how the story is being told through the cinematographer and the director and the editor, the more I can participate in my role as an actor. And at the very least, it makes it more fun to work.
I think less frustrating too. There's particularly for those of us who do smaller roles, it can be very frustrating to feel like I don't have much to do, right? And then maybe the director cuts a couple of my lines, or maybe the director comes and says, I want to just drop into the middle of this scene, you know, which happens to be my dialogue's over. And I just want to see you look at that thing, pick up the pencil, and then look to her. For many years, those kind of directions frustrated me because I didn't understand what they were for. Now they're some of the most exciting directions to get because they're hyper-specific moments that are going to tell that story, very much like what we do in that wedding scene. That look to her and then look back to your partner tells a whole entire story. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm asked to do those kinds of things now in films, I adore them. They're fun. And they're part of this, we're making the sausage together. Mm-hmm. Rather than you've taken something from me as an actor because I didn't get to say my lines again.
I will say that the limited experience I've had on sets have been incredibly eye-opening because you're on set working with series regulars and it's easy to be in the scene and not realize what they're doing. A look here, a look up, you know, maybe you miss it, maybe you're looking away or something, some tiny thing. And then you watch it and you realize how important that look was. I mean, that look was as important as the paragraph that is said.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And often, you don't see it.
Often the scene is moving to that look. Often Absolutely. The entire scene is about that look. They share a look.
Right.
And that's really why the scene is there.
Yeah, so my first experience is particularly in television. We're rehearsing a scene, and I this is not a recommendation to actors, but I've just seen it happen, is they'll go, no, I'm not going to say that. No, I don't need to say that. And then, you know, the producers come over and go, of course, we'll cut that, we'll cut that. And I was like, why are they cutting their own lines? Because they know that they want to get it as clean as possible. They know that the scene is moving towards a look or
a realization
or something passing between two people, and that the dialogue is just getting in the way. And very experienced actors, I think, know that, you know, what's really important here. And, you know, if I'm rehearsing a play, first of all, I would never do that. But, you know, when a playwright comes and says, we have to cut that scene in half, actors go, but those are my babies. I have to keep those lines because the dialogue is so much more important on the stage by and large. And So I don't know. I always find that so curious, and it took me a while to realize what they were doing and why they were doing it.
I think that it's back to what you were saying earlier about understanding the way that like the structure of a scene and how important that is. I remember when I started acting that my brother's a screenwriter in LA, and he went to school for it. And because of that, over the years, I've talked to him thousands and thousands of times about drafts of his scripts and everything like that. And I think that an understanding of the way that the scripts work is incredibly important. I mean, it's without it, you're at a severe disadvantage. And one thing, I mean, something that's so basic, but I think that most people maybe don't understand when they start out, is that especially a casual television watcher, like most of us, they don't understand that scenes, every single scene is important and every single scene accomplishes something. I think the assumption is that you watch television and you don't even see scenes necessarily. You just see one big story, a 45 minute long story, and you consume it and you watch, but you don't realize that it's broken up into scenes and each scene accomplishes something very specific. And to not understand that as an actor, it makes your job really difficult.
Yeah, I often tell my students at Brooklyn College, where we spend a lot more time on scene analysis, script analysis, if coming out of your mouth, if I ask you, why do you think this scene is here? And coming out of your mouth is, oh, I think it's just to show ... I say right away, that's a red flag. It's never just to show that you're friends. It's never just to show that you're hanging out. It's never just to show that you're cool. You never, you know, even silent scenes with someone walking down the street whistling on their own. Midnight Cowboy, that is there for a reason. It moves the story somewhere else, and it's our job to figure out why it's there. And I will say, and you feel like you've cracked this, I don't know about you, but it's so much more fun to play a scene when you know what the scene's about and why the scene's there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Playing a scene that you don't know why is there, it's like you're floating in Never Never Land. It's just very hard to grasp on to anything.
Yeah, like the students will often say, like, so what's happening in the scene? I think we're just chilling.
Yeah.
You know, there might be something more than that.
Right.
You might be trying to look like you're chilling, you know.
Right.
Characters do that all the time. They try to pretend something's no big deal. That's really fun to put on top of something, but there's always something else going on.
Well, I want to wrap this up. This has been super interesting, and I hope we get to talk again. I have a question for the two of you. People who start acting, decide that they want to be actors, they always have an idea of what their career is going to look like. You know, they have a wish that it's going to turn out this specific way. And I'm wondering, what did the two of you think careers were going to be?
I thought I was going to be hugely famous by 22, and I was not. Goes without saying.
When I met my first agent, I literally said, he said, well, what do you want to do? You know, because we have a commercial department. And I said, well, no, of course not. And he said, well, we'll try to get you on some television. I said, television? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do major motion pictures and interesting off-Broadway. I don't know. I think if I didn't have that ridiculous over-the-top hubris, I wouldn't have been able to really survive. There's something about assuming the unbelievable that gets you through a lot of the hundreds unto thousands of no's that we hear. As it's happened, I feel like I've had a very interesting career so far. I feel like it's getting better. It's not what I imagined. A lot of things have conspired to help. This unbelievable explosion of great television is just a phenomenal boon to actors.
When we were coming up, there was one show shooting in New York City.
What was it?
The Equalizer. This was before Law and Order.
Yeah, and there was nothing. And then Law and Order came, and we were all so excited. But of course, you can only really do one episode. And then once we did that one episode, that was it. And then, you know, so it took forever. So, you know, I actors coming into this landscape now, it's still hard, but they're coming into a very different world, and it's, I think, an exciting, a very, very exciting time.
Particularly for different kinds of people, you know, it was all, it's such a monolith kind of story and kind of person. And finally, it's, you know, it's breaking open so that we're seeing all kinds of different people. But that's so recent. No, things look very different than I thought they would look, but it's been really interesting along the way.
So you've both had a ton of credits. You've booked a ton of work throughout your careers. Most actors don't. Why?
Gosh, if I knew the answer to that, I would book more. If somebody asked me, what do you think are the most important elements to have to be an actor, to be a successful actor, a working actor, or whatever that means to you. And if you asked a bunch of teachers, we probably have the same 10 things, but maybe slightly in different order. But to me, talent is up there, but it's almost at the bottom of the list, because there are so many students I've worked with and so many people I came up with that I went to NYU with who took forever to start to work. Damien's one of them, actually. Damien didn't have an agent until you were, like, how old were you, 30 or something?
Yeah, like 28, 30, something like that. Yeah.
So that's 10 years of work in New York before ever getting a professional audition. So this guy that I'm sitting next to. I think the thing that you know, portends well for somebody is simply, like, who works the hardest. Mm.
I think also is
who shows up.
Is who has the capacity to keep learning. There's always an opportunity to learn. And the worst projects I've done, or the projects where I have completely tanked and I've missed the mark and I'm all wrong, and I am learning something. And I have to, you know, as bitter as sometimes that is, I have to add that to, you know, I have to go in a different direction here. I'm good at that. There's some things I'm not good at. I'm not good at asking for help. I'm not good at, you know, other things. But I think what's helped me is everything's an opportunity to learn. And that keeps my interest, and it makes me more interesting.
And I think this is a version of that, but the young actors that I see that are able to stay curious, and that's a version of wanting to learn, to keep learning, but curious about other people, curious about stories, curious about themselves, curious about the business,
curious about art, literature,
curious about everything, I see, because they're just more interesting people. And everybody responds to just interesting people. So I don't know. There is no one formula. I wish there was. I would purchase it in a heartbeat for myself. But just keep showing up.
This episode has been brought to you by Backstage. Get access to more performing arts jobs than any other platform by going to backstage.com/action to get 30 days for free. I'm Lee Foster. Thanks for listening.